Hi, everyone, and welcome to this special episode of the Passive House Podcast, recorded in Tarrytown, New York at the FiasCon 2021 Passive House Conference. Before we get started, I want to thank Fias for putting on the conference and for coordinating with us on these interviews, as well as NYSERDA for serving as conference partner with Fias and community partner with us here at the Passive House Accelerator. Thank you, too, to Rockwell North America. Their generous support underwrote all of these interviews, as well as our coverage of the conference. With that, please enjoy my interview with Bomi Jung. Welcome. We have Bomi Jung here, who is principal of Topside Advisors and also executive in residence at Stephen Winter Associates, to join us for an interview here at FiasCon. Bomi, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Zach.
Absolutely. So I would love to start with a question about the workshop that you just led. What was that about, and what were some of the key messages or processes that you went through on for that workshop?
Yeah, thank you. The workshop was, the idea behind the workshop was to as practitioners get together and talk through how we would work on incorporating climate justice into our regular everyday practice. And it arose out of a couple of different things. One is the conversation that we had for the policy forum, where we floated this idea of, like, maybe we need to just dedicate time out of our workday to think about how to do this. And then I sort of like was chewing on that with a few colleagues, and we decided to put together a workshop on, like, how would we get started on spending 10% of our working time on climate justice. And so it had basically four parts, the workshop. The first part was a presentation by Tamara Jones of Clean Energy Works, where she talked about 11 justice principles, so social justice principles, and how she had helped an organization that was a collaboration of various food hubs think about their day-to-day business and how to incorporate climate justice into their work. And so she presented that as an example. And then really had this wonderful part that I love about, you know, how you come to think about justice work and, like, how you examine where your motivation is, and so that you can do this work in a very clear-eyed kind of way. And then the second part was a presentation by Satpal Kaur, who you've had before also. And Satpal talked about bringing a beginner's mind to this particular issue of figuring out how to incorporate climate justice into a professional practice, and how that it parallels and could be modeled off of how we, as I say we, although I'm sort of more of a fangirl than a passive house practitioner, but I'll just say we for the moment, how we as passive house practitioners approach the problem of incorporating passive house into our professional practice, and what lessons could be learned from the way that you approach these sort of technical challenges, and how you could then use the same sort of mindset to approach this issue of understanding how to incorporate social justice. And then the third part was presented by Rory Christian, who's the chair of the Public Service Commission in New York State. And he talked about systems of power and how to think about systems of power using systems thinking. So, you know, going from what you observe as a fact in the world, and then sort of, you know, figuring out from that point what is the underlying mindset that results in that observable event in the world, and how do you create a solution that goes deeper than just reacting to just what you can see, but really addresses that underlying mindset that created that eventuality. And then the fourth part was sort of an invitation to the participants to fill in this question of, you know, when we're going to spend 10% of our working time figuring out how to incorporate climate justice into our professional practice by engaging these problems. And so folks sort of crowdsourced overnight, actually, crowdsourced the questions that they would want to work on. And, you know, it was really just intended as a example, just one way of figuring out what you would do to incorporate climate justice into your practice. And so I think our hope is that, you know, people look at it, and if it's useful, maybe they'll try it out. And then, you know, if not, then they'll find other ways to spend time with it and engage on it and go from talking about it and sort of having feelings about it to really moving it into the, let's do something with this space.
Right. And so what were some examples of actions that people, shared on the crowdsourcing exercise? I mean, were there some standouts or ones that caught your eye?
Well, you know, it was interesting because I didn't know what level of question would come up, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the idea is that you're sort of agenda setting to say, well, we're going to spend 10% of our time, right, which is what, like, you know, half a day a week over the course of the next month or next 3 months or 6 months or whatever. And so here are the issues that we want to engage with. And they really ranged a lot from like things that were like relatively specific, like what is the economic impact that my construction project has in the immediate neighborhood, right? So like very sort of specific, like let's, you know, dig into, you know, engage with it in some sort of a data, you know, centric exploration type of thing, to questions that were in the space of how can my practice support movement building? You know, which I thought was really an interesting, you know, range of stuff. And so I think people, you know, bring to it whatever their sort of natural problem solving mode is. And that's the whole point, is that whatever your natural problem solving mode is, like, focus your attention on this issue of, like, how do we have intentional impacts towards climate justice?
Right. And you brought condensed version of this, or some insights from this process to the Alliance meeting, and I think there was something of a call to action there. Do you want to share that?
Yeah. So it was less of a call to action, and I was literally just asking people, like, do you think that you would do something like this? Would you spend a week, you know, half a day a week grappling with this as a professional problem? And someone in the back shouted out, it's not long enough. You know, so I was like, great, spend 25% of your, no. You know, spend a whole day a week, spend, you know. So I thought it was wonderful. I think that this is the kind of thing where I could really see the Passive House community doing a fantastic job of taking kind of a nebulous problem, giving it structure, setting some guidelines around how to engage with it productively, and then training people on how to do it. You know, so I really have a lot of optimism that, you know, if this is something that we as Passive House practitioners want to grapple with, like, we have all of the intellectual and analytical and sort of, you know, problem orientation tools to make something of it more than just, you know, sort of we aspire to have goals. You know, we aspire to have, you know, uphold these values. I think that, you know, we can really make it something where it says, well, we're going to follow a methodology and a process, and we're going to measure some sort of an outcome, right? Which is what Passive House folks do.
That's a great way to frame it. And it kind of resonates with something that Johnny Resvani spoke about on a workshop around equity that he was part of on the accelerator. And that what is this notion that building on what you're talking about in terms of this sort of analytical orientation that this community has, and grappling with a big questions and figuring out how to do that in a systematic way. But the other piece is that this is a community of people who are accustomed to taking on the big things, you know, the project of decarbonizing buildings is massive. And embodied carbon shows up, and there's a, you know, an embracing of that problem as well. And how does this all, and this is actually maybe a little bit of a segue into the next question, because how does this all relate to electrification? I think it was another kind of like encouragement for this community to think, this is the next phase, this is the next issue and problem that we need to really be addressing and engaging with around climate justice.
And I was actually, I'm glad that you brought up the material, the embodied carbon conversation, because I was actually thinking of that as sort of a corollary, right? Like, just like you've expanded out to think about, well, what's embodied in the materials. And this actually brings me to a conversation that I had this morning or last night, one of those.
It's become a little bit of a blur for me personally.
And I just want to make sure, like, what I'm suggesting is not that we just come up with better checklists, right? It's about thinking about the problem in sort of a holistic way, just like you would a building science problem in a holistic way. And then sort of digging deep to say, well, how do we address this at the root? So one example is, I was speaking with an architect who, said, you know, we have this issue where, like, you know, the question of who do you actually talk to? You know, we build a new building and there's a waiting list of thousands for a building that's got 50 units. And as it is, that's already clearly a problem. And so we were sort of chewing on it back and forth a little bit. And I said, well, you know, there are some projects where, the design team has had the ability to go out and speak with the future residents, right? So, you know, obviously there's lots of different people that we call clients in our space. You know, there's the funding, you know, whoever's providing the funding, there's the developer who's actually hired you, right? There's the ultimate residents in the buildings. So, we were talking about, you know, if the problem is we need to be able to speak directly, for example, in affordable housing to the low-income residents who are going to end up in that building 2 years from the time that we start designing it, but we need to talk to them before we start the design process. There's nothing that says that we have to wait to do the lottery until the building is built. So right. If we identify that as being like a really critical problem, right, we could work on something where we say we really need to do the lottery in advance so that we can find the families that are going to live here and they can have substantive input into how we do, you know, decision making around all these issues that are fine. I mean, it's just a thing that we made up, this process, right?
Yeah, that's interesting. It's just one of those. I mean, it's probably not simple to make that change, but it conceptually, that's a simple change that could really make that the problem of figuring out how to, you know, do real engagement with future residents much easier, or much more solvable. That's cool. So you, to pivot to the work that you recently did with Rocky Mountain Institute, that you, I think, have been working on this notion of beneficial electrification and framing for us what that means in buildings. So can you share what your findings were or what your recommendations are? I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah. So... beneficial electrification, it's a funny term, right? Because, you know, we talk about electrification, everybody knows what that is. That means that you're taking a fossil fuel used and we're converting it to electricity, right? Very straightforward. And then you go, beneficial electrification, like, why are we using that term, right? And so if you look at the history of the beneficial electrification as a term, it's a utility sector term, right? It's the kind of thing that, you know, utility regulators and utility companies talk about. And the origin of it, turns out, is, you know, back in the, I guess, 70s, when there was this argument being made that electricity was an inherently inefficient fuel because of the transmission losses, right? So you're burning some sort of fossil fuel, you're making steam, you're turning, you know, you're in these thermal plants, and then you're losing a bunch of it in transmission, and then you use a little bit of it. So the gas sector folks were saying, that's actually a really inefficient thing to do. We should just switch everything that we can over to gas.
Right, right.
So then the electricity sector folks said, whoa, there are ways in which electrification is beneficial. And that's where it came from.
Oh, interesting.
And and at the time they were making arguments that were very broad. They included things like, well, you can't run computers off of gas, and computers are going to drive productivity improvements. And so that's going to be a beneficial use of electricity, yeah, for example.
Right.
It was like really interesting when digging into the history of it.
Somewhat dated, right?
Yeah.
Right.
And then, so then that was, it was sort of revived and picked up within the last few years. Again, primarily by the utility sector folks. And this time it really meant we're going to have situations where switching from fuel to gas or fuel to electricity is going to have a benefit in terms of environmental impacts. It's going to have a benefit in terms of management of the electric grid. And it's going to, on a system-wide level, have economic efficiencies. And so that was sort of the utility sector definition of beneficial electrification. And it's sort of been seeping out into conversations outside of the utility sector as we dig more into electrification as a means of decarbonization. And so it's kind of gotten to the threshold of housing. And what we wanted to try and say with this paper is if there is a rationale for adopting the term beneficial electrification for housing, and it's that it allows us to balance the core mission of housing alongside the core mission of decarbonization, right? Because you could easily envision a situation where if you really put your foot on the gas for electrification minus the beneficial bit, you could just end up saying, we're going to pay to switch fuels on housing, for example, without really looking at whether it improves housing conditions at all. And so if one of the arguments that we want to make for electrification is that it improves indoor environmental quality, for example, then you have to look at that impact of electrification on indoor environmental quality in the context of housing quality, generally speaking. And so in doing this exercise, what we ended up with is a paper that starts with a literature review of the health literature on indoor environmental quality, and particularly on the intersection of indoor environmental quality with health equity. So income and race-based health disparities. I shouldn't say indoor environmental quality, just health equity and buildings. And then the second part looks at, well, what is, from a building science perspective, what is the thing that, you know, creates those impacts, right? So how does indoor environmental quality come about from a building science perspective? And I think that there's been kind of a gap in the academic research, because oftentimes the health researchers don't really have a grounding in building science, and the building science folks, by and large, don't do health research. And so we're trying to sort of conceptually bridge that gap. And then the third part sort of goes into what state and local governments can do as part of housing policy and as part of decarbonization policy to bring these things together with the intent of having a beneficial impact on closing the health equity gap for low-income communities. And I mean, to make a long story slightly shorter, what we sort of hold up as an ideal situation, right, is passive house with no combustion in the living spaces, right? And I think that the driving factor that for the passive house community, I would really like to highlight is the quality of the passive house building that matters in this particular policy argument. It redefines what acceptable housing quality ought to be on the basis of the health impacts that you can have as a result of passive house, right? And so I know we're very used to making cost-based arguments. There's a really powerful argument about the health impacts and about housing quality. And if you're a person who, like me, feels that at the end of the day, all of our housing should be passive house, including retrofits, then the argument to really be making is about housing quality.
Right, right. I've heard you say that before, and I think it's a really powerful notion. And you've also talked about the role that the kind of the traditional role that the affordable housing community has played in defining what housing quality is. And so now there's this opportunity to do exactly that again. And boy, if there wasn't a year to bring home how important these questions are, these issues are, I mean, with the wildfire smoke that we've been dealing with, and of course with COVID. So, I applaud you for putting together this piece and helping to kind of redefine the conversation as we embrace electrification, you know, as an industry. We know electrification is super important, but let's remember how critical a better building is in all of it as well. Yeah. Well, is there anything else you want to add before we close up? As always, this has been very enlightening, Bomi. This is great.
Yeah, I mean, I just really appreciate being part of this community. Again, as a fangirl, right?
And not I will as say, I am also a fanboy. And I do the same thing where I talk about us and what we do in our projects, yeah. I think, just because I feel like I'm part of it, even if I don't do projects.
And I think, you know, it's this particular, my point of view, generally speaking, but also this particular paper, I think, had a lot to do with trying to, you know, bridge these separate disciplines, so affordable housing and the health research that, you know, that's adjacent to it, as well as the building science stuff. And really, what I would love to see is more folks doing interdisciplinary work, right? I would argue I'm not the best person even to be doing this kind of interdisciplinary work specifically because I don't actually do the projects, you know? So I would really love to see more of this going on, you know, at the research level, at the policy level, at the advocacy level. Yeah.
Great. Well, all right, everyone, get to work. All right.
Thanks, Zach. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Bomi.